In his first State of the Union message as president in January 1964, Lyndon Johnson announced,
"This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America. We shall not rest until that war is won."
Johnson's language was striking. As the London Sunday Times noted,
"It was to be a war on poverty. Federal funds were to be fired into pockets of poverty in what was known in Washington as the rifle shot approach. He actually spoke of throttling want."
American presidents liked declaring war on some problem or other. Witness Richard Nixon's war on drugs or George W. Bush's war on terror. But why a war on poverty in 1964? The answer tells us a lot about 60s America, and even more about Lyndon Baines Johnson, one of the most remarkable and most flawed presidents of the 20th century. The United States always had an underclass of poor, but in the 1960s, Americans rediscovered poverty. Commentator Michael Harrington wrote in his 1962 bestseller entitled The Other America,
"Living out in the suburbs, it is easy to assume that ours is indeed an affluent society. The other America does not contain the adventurous seeking a new life and land. It is populated by the failures, those driven from the land and bewildered by the city, by old people suddenly confronted by the torments of loneliness and poverty, and by minorities facing a wall of prejudice."
Back in the Depression of the 1930s, America's leaders had addressed the problem of poverty because it was staring them in the face on every street corner. But in the early 1960s, poverty seemed remote. Suburban America was in a boom, not a depression. The campuses were quiet, and the ghettos had not yet started to burn. Poverty wasn't a must-do, but a can-do issue. It should be solved because it was an affront to American wealth and values. John Kennedy, Johnson's predecessor as president, had been concerned about issues of social welfare. In fact, he coined the term war on poverty in 1960, having been deeply stirred by the grinding misery of the coal mining towns of West Virginia. But Kennedy, as we shall see, was preeminently a foreign policy president, preoccupied by the Cold War, not by a war on poverty. He tried to get Congress to pass bills on health care and education, but made little progress against a conservative coalition from both parties. By November 1963, Kennedy had gained acceptance for less than a third of his legislative program. And then he was assassinated.
"Something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by just a moment, please."
Just a moment. We have a bulletin coming in. We now switch you directly to Parkland Hospital and KBOX News Director Bill Hampton.
"The President of the United States is dead."
Whether his killer Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman or part of a larger conspiracy obsessed Americans at the time and continues to provoke debate. What is unquestionable, however, is the effect of the murder on Kennedy's reputation, turning him into a martyr.
"There was the sound of laughter, and in a moment, it was no more."
This was partly the effect of his funeral, one of the earliest truly international TV events, thanks to satellite broadcasting.
"There was a father with a little boy and a little girl."
Millions in America and around the world watched every movement of his gravely beautiful widow, Jacqueline, attired in black, and her two small children as they followed the coffin to Arlington National Cemetery.
"So she kissed him and closed the lid of the coffin."
But the Kennedy myth was also testimony to Jackie's own legacy project, recorded by journalist Theodore White soon afterwards.
"She did not want Jack left to the historians. What she was saying to me now was,
"Please, history, be kind to John F. Kennedy."
She believed, and John F. Kennedy shared the belief, that history belongs to heroes, and heroes must not be forgotten.
The heroic image that fixated Jackie was King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, captured in some lines from the Broadway musical Camelot. White quoted her in the article he wrote for Life magazine.
"At night, before we'd go to sleep, Jack liked to play some records, and the song he loved most came at the very end of this record.
Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment.
That was known as Camelot."
And she added,
"It will never be that way again."
Enter Lyndon Johnson, the son of a struggling Texas hill farmer, not of a Boston tycoon and U.S. ambassador to Britain. A graduate not of Harvard University, but Southwest Texas State Teachers College. And the man whom Kennedy had defeated for the Democratic nomination in 1960. Johnson got the vice presidency as a consolation prize. But Johnson's hardest political cross was being Southern. Since the Civil War, no Southerner apart from Woodrow Wilson had been president, and LBJ had real doubts that things would change during his lifetime. Back in 1958, when as a senator Johnson arrived for a meeting in the White House, a grinning Eisenhower gestured to the high-backed president's chair.
You sit there.
Oh, no, that's your chair, Mr. President.
It'll be yours someday.
No, I will never sit in that chair.
Then suddenly, in November 1963, Johnson got his chance, and he was determined to use it well. Shrewdly, he assumed the mantle of the slain president, telling Congress that
the ideas and the ideals which he so nobly represented must and will be translated into effective action. So let us here highly resolve that John Fitzgerald Kennedy did not live or die in vain.
But in private, Johnson had little time for Kennedy. He told one historian,
"To tell the truth, John F. Kennedy was a little too conservative to suit my taste. No man knew less about Congress than John Kennedy. When he was young, he was always off to Boston or Florida for long weekends. I never saw him eating with another congressman once."
Johnson, by contrast, had lived and breathed Congress for 30 years, making his way up the House and then the Senate. A bear-like 6'3", he possessed legendary skills as a manipulator. According to one journalistic account of what was called the treatment,
"It could last 10 minutes or 4 hours. Its tone could be supplication, accusation, cajolery, exuberance, scorn, tears, complaint, the hint of threat. Johnson moved in close, his face a scant millimeter from his target, his eyes widening and narrowing, his eyebrows rising and falling. Mimicry, humor, and the genius of analogy made the treatment an almost hypnotic experience and rendered the target stunned and helpless."
But it wasn't just political skill that enabled him to push through reforms. In the election of November 1964, Johnson also gained a crushing victory, winning 61% of the popular vote, the largest share in U.S. political history to date, now making him president in his own right. So it was LBJ, not Kennedy, who mounted the war on poverty and pushed through his Great Society program. Johnson's Education Act of 1965 was the first time that large amounts of federal money had been allocated to schools, with priority for compensatory education for the poor. In 3 months, he turned into reality ideas that Congress had debated for 20 years. Deliberately, LBJ signed the bill into law in the one-room schoolhouse in Texas where he had been educated.
As a son of a tenant farmer, I know that education is the only valid passport from poverty. As President of the United States, I believe deeply no law I have signed or will ever sign means more to the future of America.
Next to be rammed through Congress was health care reform. Once again, Johnson, the supreme lawmaker, gave hostile interest groups the treatment, particularly the powerful American Medical Association, or AMA. When one union leader expressed his fears that the AMA wouldn't cooperate, Johnson asked if he'd ever fed chickens. No, was the puzzled reply. Well, said the president,
chickens are real dumb. They eat and eat and never stop. Why, they start shitting at the same time they're eating, and before you know it, they're knee-deep in their own shit. Well, the AMA's the same. They've been eating and eating non-stop. Now they're knee-deep in their own shit, and everybody knows it. They won't be able to stop anything.
Johnson was right. The two planks of his reforms were Medicare and Medicaid. These were the biggest innovations in social welfare since Roosevelt's Social Security Act of 1935. Both education reform and health care were aimed particularly at America's blacks. And as we've seen, racial issues were central to the Voting Rights Act. This, the third of Johnson's great social reforms of 1965, was signed into law in August. When historian William Lichtenberg was given a special interview with LBJ in September of that year, he decided to ingratiate himself with an opening remark.
Mr. President, this has been a remarkable Congress. It is even arguable whether this isn't the most significant Congress ever.
Johnson snapped.
No, it isn't. It's not arguable.
LBJ's legislative accomplishments ranked with earlier Democrats such as Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, each brilliant leaders aided by a briefly favorable political balance in Congress. The president particularly eulogized Roosevelt.
He was like a daddy to me.
But he clearly thought himself Roosevelt's superior as a master legislator.
In 1936, Roosevelt won by a landslide. But he was like the fella who cut cordwood and sold it all at Christmas and then spent it all on firecrackers. It all went up with a bang.
LBJ was supremely confident that this wouldn't happen to his presidency. Hubris indeed. In 1968, 4 years after winning the biggest landslide to date in U.S. electoral history, Johnson was so unpopular that he dared not run for re-election. The war on poverty made Johnson. The war in Vietnam would break him utterly.